You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What I found really interesting is, you know, when I think about his history, mm-hmm. he went from like 15-year-old homeless to like a self-taught artist. And actually in 2017, one of his paintings sold for $110 million. It set the record for the most expensive painting by an American artist.
I know, that's insane. A wild story, and I think that's what drew me to him in the first place.
Yeah, and so in some ways I think there's a little bit of truth to this quote from him. It says, "I'm not a real person, I'm a legend." And the legend, of course, is Jean-Michel Basquiat.
I feel like, who art ed?
Who art ed?
Mr. Wood, art ed me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's
off
to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, the podcast where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood. And as always, you can find pictures of the work being discussed on Twitter at WoodArtEd and the website, whoartedpodcast.com. Joining me today, I have Mr. Todd Lieben, art teacher from Oak Park. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Not a problem. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to be here too. I love talking to someone from Oak Park because, like, when I was looking for a job teaching, Oak Park was the one district that had the good sense not to hire me.
That's tough. Oddly enough, I never, when I was going through art ed and I pictured a grade level, middle school was not on my radar, but my placement for student teaching was in Oak Park.
Isn't it funny how those things happen?
Yeah.
There's so much.
I got to know, you know, the staff and people there at that time, and position opened up and there you go. But
yeah, so much seems to be serendipitous. Like, I had no intention of elementary when I started off, and now, like, cause you know, you know, we get certified K-12, and I pictured myself in high school all throughout the time I was in school. And then I found, like, just elementary. The kids are so fun. The energy is so fun. Love it.
Yeah, I was a teacher's aide in an art classroom with my former elementary art teacher, because I was doing summer maintenance as my first job. And it was in the same school district I went to. So I had always kept in contact with my art teacher, Mrs. Alvarez, from the district 92 and a half. But it was fun. I ended up as her teacher's aide, and that was with an elementary level. So I guess I always thought I'd be there, but middle school's been a good fit.
Yeah, life's all it's always about connections too, because, like, I am where I am, the cooperating teacher. When I was doing my high school placement, cooperating teacher was over at Neuqua. Her kids went to school at Highlands, where I teach now. And so, like, when I was interviewing, you know, like, I had these different people who were making connections, and they're like, oh yeah, I know so-and-so over there. I'll put in a word for you and stuff like that. Worked out.
Yeah.
Like I said, really well.
That's awesome. I mean, sometimes, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, sometimes the universe seems to know what it's doing. It was just kind of like in line with the theme I saw with Basquiat. As I get into, like, his biography, you'll notice, like, there are a lot of connections that come up.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And some that, like with Warhol, how he just kind of put himself out there too. I thought that was great.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. So I guess to start off, you know, we're talking about Jean-Michel Basquiat, the American artist, became popular starting in the 1980s, but he was born December 22nd, 1960, born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. His background, Haitian and Puerto Rican descent. And you know, one of the things that I've noticed in looking at his biography is he was a smart kid from the early age, you know, like from 4 years old, he learned to read and write by four. Like that right there, that's kind of nuts. And his mom was very encouraging of his talent. So like she took him to the museums. I think he was like a junior member at the museum when he was like 6 years old. And then when he was 7 years old, he got hit by a car, broke his arm, had some other internal injuries and stuff. So he was recovering for a little while. And his mother gave him a copy of Grey's Anatomy, which is like that like medical textbook.
Oddly enough, after reading that part of his history, I very shortly after owned a copy of Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I went out and searched it out. It was just one of those things where, like, when you're a fan, you wanted to search out all this other stuff surrounding it. So I got Grey's Anatomy and one of my favorites is called The Symbol Sourcebook. So
interesting.
That was another one that was mentioned that he loved too. So
yeah, and I think it's interesting when you think about like a 7 year old reading a medical textbook, you know. But it showed up later in his work. We saw a lot of, you know, bones and skeletal imagery coming through in his later work. So it clearly had an impact. And, you know, studying anatomy, that is something artists have been doing for a long time. You know, used to be the cadavers were fought over by medical students and artists, you know, like they're looking at how the body is put together.
Yeah, his mom definitely nurtured him well.
Yeah, she did nurture him well. And, you know, I always got the sense reading that he was very close with his mother. And aside from getting hit by a car, the real major setback for him, I think, was when he was 15 and his mother's mental illness, you know, became sort of untenable, an unlivable situation. So she went to live in a facility that could help to take care of her and get her the needs, like, you know, get her the help that she needed, but she was no longer able to take care of him.
Yeah.
You know? And so at 15, he was dealing with that. 15 in the late 70s, he was getting into some trouble as a kid. Like some of it seems kind of funny. Like, you know, he got kicked out of the alternative school for pieing the principal, which, you know, it's disrespectful, but it seems, you know, generally harmless.
Yeah.
And funny in a lot of ways, but at the same time, there were some serious struggles there. Like he was homeless for a little while as a teenager. He started a graffiti project, which I can't always recommend graffiti to people, but it is, right, it is a way that people get their artwork out there. And that's how he built his name. He and a friend worked collaboratively. Al Diaz was the other member on the SAMO project. So yep, with that, you know, it was just sort of, they were spray painting and tagging in Manhattan, where all the money is, where all the powerful and influential people are. And they were doing stuff. It was very text-based, a lot of words and phrases on buildings. And then I guess after a few years, he got kind of tired of the same old thing. So he put an end to the SAMO project with, I think it was just a tag that said, "SAMO is dead."
I believe that's my recollection too.
I believe that was the phrasing he used, yeah. And that was in 1980. 1980 seems to have been a time where he started to really strike it out and make a name for himself as a studio artist of sorts. Like he was using his art to support himself. As I said, when he got kicked out and dropped out of school, he left home for a while. I think at first on his own, he ran away. And then I believe he got kicked out like when he was 17. And he crashed on friends' couches and he supported himself by selling postcards and things like that that he made. And I guess he even saw Andy Warhol in Soho and ran up and sold him a postcard.
It's great that he seemed to be like in the know, you know, and it's interesting his progression, because he definitely earned his place when you see his backstory and, you know, his boldness in working through. And like we see with a lot of students, the ones that are really bright sometimes can end up in, with their path. They get into some trouble later on.
Well, it's like sometimes the choices people make, they are their own worst enemies, correct. You know. I think you and I have probably both known a lot of very talented people who did not, you know, make the most of those talents. But yeah. There are some people who really do like reach out and make the most of it. And it's fantastic. And he was working hard. You know, he did not have the easiest path. He did not come from the family with the wealth and the connections to support him. He was a self-taught artist. He didn't go to Yale or SAIC. He, you know, taught himself a lot. And he was hustling. He was selling his art on the streets and apparently able to do that enough to make a living. And when he recognized somebody who could help him in that path, you know, he reached out. He ran out to sell Warhol the postcard.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Calm Cove podcast can help you sleep deeply all night long. Calm Cove has deeply relaxing meditation music and ambient sounds, like ocean waves and crackling fires. All of our episodes are designed to help you relax and to fall asleep fast. Calm Cove is brought to you by the team behind Sleep Cove, the sleep podcast that consists of spoken word hypnosis, meditation, and stories. So if you want to listen to a beautiful soundscape tonight, search for Calm Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and see how we're helping millions of people relax and go to sleep every night.
And he started to get a little bit of press with the Samo project. That got him a feature in, is it the Village Voice? Yeah.
Yeah.
And he got like featured there, and he was also on the Public Access show, which I always think of like Public Access as like, you know, when I was growing up in the suburbs of Chicago, nobody was watching Public Access. Right. But in New York City, Public Access has a little bit larger of an audience. There's a little bit more to it. Yeah. And he was on, made multiple appearances on the Public Access program TV Party. And then he was also in that guy's, Glenn O'Brien being the host of that. He was also in a film that he made called Downtown 81. And that featured also like Debbie Harry from Blondie.
Yeah. You know?
So he was starting to make those connections first with the Samo project, and then as his own artist and a personality on the scene. He actually sold his first painting to Debbie Harry. I think it was like for $400, maybe $200. I've seen different, wow. But like, you know, his first painting supposedly was sold to Debbie Harry, which, you know, kudos to her for having good taste. She's probably a really good investment. It was probably done just because she saw him like, oh, here's this starving artist. And then, you know, paid off, that act of kindness paid off well. Kindness or good taste?
Probably a little bit of both.
A little bit of both.
Yeah.
And so by like 1981, he's starting to be participating in group shows with people like Keith Haring, Barbara Kruger. Like, I just get the sense that in New York in like the late 70s and 80s, just like all the famous people were hanging out constantly.
That's what it seemed like with all the stories told. Yeah.
It really does seem like that. Because later on, I think he was like dating Madonna just before she became famous. Yeah. And, you know, he's introduced to Warhol. They meet for lunch. They became friends. I guess like it said that after that lunch, when he first met Warhol sort of formally and not just like running up to him to sell him something on the street, when they met for lunch, Basquiat went back to his studio and painted a portrait of the two of them together. And then they actually did a series of paintings back and forth together. They were friends, like I said, basically till the end there. And, you know, in this time, he's starting to get that little bit more, a little bit more recognition, and obviously a lot more money that comes with that as he becomes this internationally acclaimed artist. And I found it really interesting. He developed this habit of painting in expensive Armani suits, which I don't know about you. Like, I find it kind of funny because on the one hand, it seems just like bonkers for to be like spending so much money on that. And at the same time, it feels like this really sort of punk rock kind of irreverent, like I'm going to take those signifiers of high society and quote unquote cultured elites and just like totally bring it down to the level of like overalls. And I'm going to paint in that suit.
Yeah. He's trying to change perspectives. And I do agree that is, that's such a punk rock move. And, you know, he kind of was the underdog for the longest time, but, once again, connections went out and, he started to build really strong ones.
Yeah. So I think that fairly well covers the context. And like I say, the punk rock ethos, you know, that was the 1970s and 80s was the heyday of at least the sort of first wave of punk. And that was coming up in culture. It's just like graffiti culture. You know, I referenced Keith Haring, mm-hmm. was another prominent artist rising to fame at that time. And so now what I always like to do is a little bit of a deeper dive into one of the works. And I guess I'll leave it to you. Which one would you like to do? When I first thought this, like the Untitled Skull piece from 1981 is one that's always sort of struck me.
Same.
But the 82 Untitled, that's the one that set the record. Do you have a preference which one you'd like to focus
on? It's odd. They're fun to see together because you can see very similar yet different, you know, approach to it. I would love to talk about the Untitled 81.
Cool. Perfect. So I always like to start, like, what's jumping out to you about this piece? What are you noticing?
I just think the energy that's in it. I mean, he's got a very strong use of complementary colors, but there's a huge amount of layering going on here. I was always fascinated too with oil stick and knowing that he had used those, of course, while I'm in college at Illinois State, I had gone to the art shops a lot and I'm like, I need to get these oil sticks because I just like the look of them, the saturation of color that you could get with them. And I just felt like I had to dig in, but yeah, all this detail and it's his use of color.
See, that's interesting because I actually found oil sticks like really appealing to me until I started using them, and then I really didn't like them.
I confess, it's not that I ended up using them strongly in stuff, but I just wanted to experience the material. I don't think any work survived that was used with oil stick by me, but I was inspired.
Yeah, it's definitely one I never mastered. Although I focused a lot on painting, I was definitely better with the brush, which surprised me because I started off so much drawing.
Yeah. But
when I'm looking at this piece, what I'm noticing is like it feels like this head that, you know, we see the eyes almost look like they're looking in different directions. And it's this head that feels a little bit like a skull because the fact that I can see like the teeth fully, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like the jaw is almost like been sort of like, it feels like a skull where the flesh is gone and I can see the teeth down to the roots. And I see like the contours of that, but then at the same time, I still see the eyes in the eye sockets. Right. And so it occupies to me this odd space that is like, it's like a zombie. It has a little bit of life to it, but not quite all the flesh there, you know? Yeah,
that juxtaposition is really interesting because when you look at the shape overall, you would think skull. And even though it's sort of like extended or stretched out, that on the right side, that the heavy kind of point, not pointed, but that heavier curve almost looks like the back end of the mandible too.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, like we say, there is, the nose is still there. But at the same time, while we see that white line that defines the contour of a nose that is there, and the red line that defines sort of the edge of a nostril, the black triangle has the feel of the empty socket. Not quite a socket, I guess. It's a hole where like the nasal cavity would be.
Yeah.
You know? So it's doing this weird thing where it's treading this line of both a skull and a head with the flesh at the same time. And as I look at this, that mark making, it's one of those things that often caused his work to be dismissed and panned by some critics in his day, and still today probably, because this is what, to use like the problematic term that was often used to dismiss his work, it was referred to as sort of primitivist, right. You know, where it feels raw. And I think the better term is it's expressionistic, you know?
I had trouble with that term too. It was almost if like when they described it, they were using it as a way to put him down.
Absolutely. It's one of those terms that, you know, it's like, you know, he was a self-taught artist, and you know, that could be derisively put down as an outsider art. You know, he wasn't from the academy. He didn't have the formal training. You know, we use so many different terms in art that I think are in some ways purposefully and in some ways accidentally dismissive. Like I really don't like the term folk art because it's so broad as to be meaningless. Right. And, you know, because folk art is just from any culture, really, and any time. But it always means, like, the things that the ordinary people are making, not, you know, the quote-unquote fine artists.
Right.
Which creates this high-low thing. And critics in his day talked about him in really demeaning terms sometimes. I've seen quotes where he was called a talentless hustler and street smart, but otherwise invincibly ignorant. Like, he was a lot of things. He was not ignorant.
No, I think people tried to put him into a box too. You know, they think, you know, oh, I know him. We got him pegged down. And I think that he was too elusive for that.
Well, yeah. I mean, like he, you know, when you see like the biography of, you know, he was a high school dropout and homeless as a teenager, you don't expect to find he also spoke three languages fluently.
Right.
You know, but like for all of his faults and all of his problems, he was very thoughtful. He studied, he looked through like textbooks that he got from friends. Like while he was staying at their houses and in their apartments, he was reading their books and he was learning and he was taking things in from all different sources. Yeah. He was not only painting, but he was also like, he was rapping, he was writing, he was appearing in films. He was doing everything, just all about culture and taking it all in and seeing what he could make and what he could put out there, which I think is really interesting about him. But back to this specific piece, I gotta say one thing that I'm absolutely loving about it is the energy of the lines and the movement and the like you said in the beginning, the complementary color scheme and like the intensity of those colors, which I find really impressive because, you know, as well as I do, complementary colors next to each other, it's going to look bright and bold and intense. But when they mix, it gets muddy. And some of this looks like it's, like you said, it's layered. And some of this looks like it's layered on top. And some of it looks like it's almost like layered and then scratched away.
Yeah.
And to do that while preserving that intensity of hue, it's really impressive. It's hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm also kind of drawn to how he uses that orange to sort of frame out the right, you know, bottom corner and right upper corner. But then you see those colors reflected in the jaw. So it's that juxtaposition of almost that orange on blue and then the blue on orange.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really liking this for the way he balances all of those competing things, whether it's with the color or the suggestion of what that head and what that head or skull is. You know, it all seems to be this high wire act. Like, yeah. I look at this and I think about, like, how could I recreate that? And if I'm being honest, I don't know that I could, you know?
No, like, I think that all happens in the moment. You know, you problem solve and you work through and you just follow your vision the best you can.
Yeah. And I like that there's this evidence of process, but like everything, it has this feel of, because of all of the lines, it has this feel to me like Giacometti's work, where you can see the artist is on that quest to get to the right line. Yeah. But then he's got all of these that are clearly just like, a confident, it is one mark, that's what it is, and that was exactly the right mark. Yeah. You know, like inside of the head, there's this mess of lines at the top, but then as you look down, it is much more just like one swoop for the nostril, one swoop to outline the jaw, you know?
Yeah. And I also, I just love that use of blue, you know, that naturally sort of recedes in the focal point, which is the face. And I almost try to imagine that bottom right corner without all those blue scratches. And I feel like those are intentional and smart, because if that was just an area of orange, I think your eye would go off of the artwork. I think that kind of helps keep you in.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they do. Like, it's that repetition of the same color to balance it out, but then they're also like these marks that are pointing you back towards.
Yeah, they initially seem sloppy, but are totally intentional.
Yeah, it's that what sprezzatura, to use the pretentious art term, for a studied carelessness or a clumsy grace. You know, his work is loaded with that, where like at first glance it looks so sloppy, but then like as you deconstruct it and look at what every line and every color is doing, it's much more clever and much more purposeful than it might at first appear.
Yeah.
And really it's much more difficult to do, because it doesn't devolve into like muddy mess and chaos.
Agreed. And I want to say it's not formulaic, in which, you know, we kind of think of different art skills that you would do to build up and layer. But I mean, there's definitely a formula in his head for how he works, but it's not a clear cut path from start to finish.
Yeah. Love it. Anything else you want to say about this one?
No, I just love it. I'm trying to remember now that I see this one too. This may be one of the first ones that drew me into his work. And I can't, you know, pinpoint for sure where I first heard about it, but obviously being an art ed, I'm sure it came across, you know, my workspace at that point and got me intrigued. But
yeah, I feel like this one is one of the standouts of his body of work. Like, I've looked at a lot of his stuff and he had a consistent style, and, you know, all of it, like I say, the best I can, it feels like a high wire act. Because yeah. When you're layering that much in oil and everything like that, like it's not always forgiving.
Yeah, you know? And as you look through the body of work too, you do see that, you know, he did, you know, similar works as you go by. It's, you know, kind of a point, case in point, to the 1982 one, but yeah. Still, there's always one that just seems so much more refined and ready to go to stand out.
Well, yeah, the 81 piece, I feel like it's just better balanced than the other one. And I think it's largely because of the heavier use of complementary colors. We see more of that blue and orange, yellow and orange color scheme. Yep. And I think like you know, there's a little bit more weight to the warm colors in the 1981 piece, whereas the 82 piece is a lot more in the cool to neutral.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's, to me, that's what balances it out a little bit better.
I'm wrapping it up. I want just a 3-point rating scale. And where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from? Or the Louvre? British for the bathroom.
Yeah,
there's the Louvre joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
Out of those three choices, obviously for me, not the last one. But the other ones are kind of interesting. I mean, I think that his work and his legacy is worthy of the Louvre. But I think with his attitude and his expression and how he went about living his life, I don't know. I feel like it needs to be in a New York club or something.
Yeah.
It just needs to be there to be celebrated and lit and just, you know, have people feed off the energy.
It should be out in the wild.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Yeah. It should be unleashed. I get that. I appreciate that. And I like that you don't feel confined by the structure of the phrasing of the question, which is totally in line with Basquiat to just be like, I reject your premise. I'm going to substitute my own. I like that. I'm going to say this to me feels like a museum piece because it's gorgeous. I think it's really nice to look at. And I think there's a lot to, like, it's visually pleasing right from the instant I look at it. And the more I look at it, the more I appreciate. And that's to me, like, what museums are all about, is that artwork that you can linger on and look at and enjoy as well as learn from. And it should be preserved for everyone to see.
Yeah, so. I would agree with that too, especially with his place in the, you know, within art history too. Yeah. That it stands with all those other works too.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, the museums need a little bit of punk rock in them.
Yeah, for sure.
Although he was a rapper, so I don't know why I keep going to, I think that's like showing my own biases because I love punk rock. because he was into a totally different, but also submersive and bottom up musical art form.
Yeah, see, there we are trying to label them, and it's not sticking.
It's not sticking at all. It's not sticking at all. Much like when Blondie rapped.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they did.
I heard that, but I'm not sure that I can go back and find it out.
It was not great. It's not great. But I think that's probably good for this episode on Basquiat. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem. This was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted. If you found this tolerable, please like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week in the show notes on Twitter at WoodArtEd and on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.